This is Vicky Tobias from the University Archives. It is Tuesday, August 7th, 2012, and I'm here with Amanda, or Mandy Pertzborn, and we are here to interview Betty Barnes. And today we're going to be talking a little bit about Betty's life and career at UW-Madison, her association with the Graduate Women in Sciences, and other topics that she chooses to discuss. So if we could just introduce ourselves, Mandy, if you would like to next.
Yep, so this is Mandy Pertzborn, currently a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a former vice president of the Beta Chapter of Graduate Women in Science.
And I am Betty Barnes, retired senior lecturer in physiology, emerita. And I served almost all of the offices in Graduate Women in Science, both at the local and the national level, over the years. I first joined in 1947. That might give you an idea.
That's great. I think, you know, if you could start maybe by telling us a little bit about what led you to attend UW-Madison in the first place. What decisions or experiences prompted that decision and led you to Madison?
Well, I consider myself fortunate because coming from the 1930s, my parents both were college educated. And in those days, that was kind of unusual. And education was important to both of them, and I was always encouraged. Nobody ever said, why are you taking these courses? Why are you taking science? And we didn't have much in my little town. We alternated, there was no general science. We alternated algebra and geometry, and we alternated chemistry and physics, and that was it.
Where were you from?
It's a little town, Schoolcraft, near Kalamazoo.
Okay.
Michigan.
Yeah.
And so, when I graduated from high school there, my father and one of my uncles had graduated from Kalamazoo College, my mother from Western, and I did win a competitive scholarship, and so I went to Kalamazoo College. And I didn't know what I wanted to, I said I was going to be a lawyer maybe because my dad always going to be a lawyer stuff, and I just had no idea, although I had taken all this science. So I took biology, and the biology teacher, now remember, this is 1945, so things are quite different. This is the end of the war. No, this is 41, the beginning, to go to college, 1941. So the war is in full swing. And there were not a huge number of fellows on campus ever. So it was pretty serious. You could really get an education. But anyway, I took biology. This first I had any connection with biology. And the teacher was a woman. Mm-hmm. She was the only one in the department. Her name is Frances Diebold. And she came from Madison. Her parents still lived on Lathrop Street and took in students. Mm-hmm. And so she had that connection. And so in 2 years I had a major. This was what I liked, was biology. And I also took enough I had more chemistry than biology, and enough physics so that I could teach, which is what I planned to do, you know, in high school. And in my senior year someplace, she said to me, would you like to go to grad school? Mm-hmm. Well, I'd never thought about it.
Sure.
And of course I would like to go to grad school. And my parents were very supportive of that. Although I had an engagement ring, my former husband was in China Burma India Theater of the War, and he'd been there for 3 years. So, you know, so I just looked at it as a real opportunity. There were some people in town who said, oh, what does she want more education? She's just going to get married, you know. And my father bristled and said, no education is ever wasted. Of course she's going.
That's fantastic.
You know, that would be 1945. So I came up here, And my mentor was R.K. Meyer, who was an endocrinologist, a nationally known one. And so I was really very lucky because I had those two people for mentors. And these really were mentors. They'd remained friends, you know, all my life, mm-hmm. long before we'd used that word,
yeah.
you know. And so I consider myself very fortunate. And so I was in zoology. Mm-hmm. And he was in endocrinology, which I liked very much. And then he sort of veered, we did, into reproductive physiology because I pretty much stayed with him until he retired in 1972. And from reproductive physiology, when he retired, then I went over to physiology department for the last 20 years.
Okay. So you started out then being a lecturer in zoology? In the zoology
yeah.
department?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
Well, it was nice. Senior lecturer. And the reason I didn't do tenure track and I never finished, I did all the coursework and everything for the PhD, and I could have, I think, very quickly done something. I had it in mind for research. But they said, if you do, you'll work yourself out of this job in physiology, which I liked.
Oh, interesting.
So I just never finished, and mm-hmm. it's one of the things, you know, it's there, but I'm not letting it bother me, the fact that I never did finish. But I did not like straight bench work, mm-hmm. straight research. Mm-hmm. Before I came up here, Upjohn Company was in Kalamazoo, mm-hmm. and Deeb had placed people in the summers to help it, you know, in at the Upjohn Company, and I worked for Dwight Ingle in endocrinology in 44 and again in 45, and he was working on adrenocorticoids and burns. He was trying to see if adrenocorticoids could help with the war effort, you know, because so many men were being burned.
Yeah.
Everything went toward the war. The antibiotics had penicillin had been discovered and so on, but we in the country never got it. It all went to the war. So anyway, I worked for him, and it was okay. But then after I got up here and was doing, you know, just basic research, I decided it's just not for me. I just would rather be with people.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked out very well that I helped him with all his courses, and then when he retired, then I went over to physiology, and I helped with the big course that is team taught. I don't know if you know about that, but there are about 600 people, or there were, I don't know what the story is now. 600 took physiology, and it started out as a 101, and then we went to the 200 level, mm-hmm. and when I left, it was a 300 level, so it's not a SNAP course. And everybody takes it, mm-hmm. except the med students. They had their own 700 course. Yeah. But so this means PTs, OTs, med techs, nursing, and at first, physical education majors took our course, but then it got too much for them. So they got their own course. But back in those first days, I had some of the real heroes of the athletic department and some good friends. One was Mike Webster, who was the Pittsburgh Pirates, and I don't mean Pittsburgh Pirates,
Steelers.
Yep. Yeah. And he was a gentle giant. I can see him yet. He was sort of pigeon-toed, but a great big guy, you know. And really a gentleman and just so nice. And I just felt terrible over the years. And I watched this concussion business, you know, because
yeah.
he played every single game for years and years. And I don't know why his family, why somebody didn't take better care of him, you know, because he was living in his car.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was awful. He was the first one, I think, that people noticed
yeah.
And knew about with the concussions. Some of the others I had were Mike Eaves, yeah. And the Johnson boys, Mark Johnson and his brother Peter.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In physiology, they were interesting. The Johnson boys were content with C's, but Mike Eaves is always an achiever. Without any background at all, he got an A in.
That's cool.
He got an A in physiology. I suspect at that time it was at the 200 level, but, yeah. You know, that gives you an idea of. So that was, you know, that was kind of interesting. And going way back, if we want to go to the athletic department, when in the early 46 and so on, when I first got there, the athletic department had to report every week for people's eligibility.
Really?
Yeah. And so then, and then when the GI Bill came and the GIC, we had, I got credit for taking roll for all those GIs. They had to sort of sit in the same place, you know, or else come up to me afterwards and tell me where they were, because they you had to keep roll. I mean, it was kind of militarized. Well, you see, they had to know they were there.
Yeah.
But anyway, the one fellow who just didn't give a darn, he was just there to play football, was named Jug Girard. Did you ever hear of Jug Girard?
No, but it's a great name.
Yeah, his name was Earl, I think, but they called him Jug. And he was so lackadaisical, they finally hired another athletic department student just to throw him around to see what he showed. I don't think he ever did anything. And I don't think he'd stayed more than a year or two. And he did have a little time in the pros, but yeah.
That's great.
Oh, yeah. It was sort of interesting, you know, what some of those people did.
Betty, backing up a little bit as well, do you have, what were your first impressions of Madison when you arrived here? Thinking about comparing it to your...
Oh, much bigger. And I have always been grateful for the progression from a little town to a small college, really, and it was smaller than usual in those days.
Sure.
To here, if I had gone directly to this place, I'd have been completely lost, you know. But it was okay. And we were pretty parochial, you know. We stayed pretty much in this area because nobody had a car, you know. And so you were pretty much in the campus area and State Street.
How did you get to Madison? Did you take a train or a bus?
My good friend, who had been my college roommate, also came. And we lived together for the first year. Mm-hmm. And her parents brought us. My parents took me to St. Joseph, you know, and then they brought us the rest of the way.
Mm-hmm.
So that we lived in an apartment together, yeah. For the first year, and then we were both married, so that took care of it. She finished up with a PhD, and she was one of the pioneers in amniocentesis work in Cincinnati.
What was her name?
Soukup, S-O-U-K-U-P.
And she was your friend and classmate from Kalamazoo.
And then, yeah, she got her PhD here and then went to Cincinnati. She just died. And the interesting thing was my name was Brown, so all we did was put brown and white gingham on the... everybody knew who it was.
So you mentioned that you got married very shortly after you arrived in Madison.
A year later.
What was that like to be a married student on campus at that time?
It was not unusual.
Mm-hmm.
When I was an undergrad at Kalamazoo College, one of the girls married before her boyfriend went overseas, and they threw her out of the dorm.
She couldn't
even hear her. She would corrupt the rest of us, you know.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So even in that short period of time, but most everybody was married. And the problem was finding a place to live.
Where did you live?
We lived $27 a month on the triangle there on Mills and Dayton.
Oh, which there, is now the
there's an apartment there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there were several, well, there were the street had houses in those days. Mm-hmm. And we lived in that first one upstairs. We didn't have a refrigerator. We had an ice box. We shared a bathroom with the landlady who lived in the other rooms upstairs and the family downstairs, you know, for the tub. They had a stool, but it was crazy. But see, it was only a block.
Sure.
Right, sure.
And so we felt ourselves fortunate because some were at Camp Randall. There was a trailer park at Camp Randall.
Yeah.
And before all the engineering was out there, and the rest of them went to the river.
That's right, to Badger Village.
So that the guys would leave early in the morning and most of them would take the last bus back because they were doing their research after they were done with their other things. So they only saw their families on the weekend. So we considered ourselves fortunate.
But, sure, sure.
But there were only a couple of cars in the whole bunch. So once in a while we'd all pile in, and those were the days before you had to, there was a limit. And we'd go to Lake Ripley in Cambridge or someplace.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
Although we didn't have to go far to have fun, you know. In those days, we just went down off the pier. The old limnology lab was right at the end of the pier. And so we just, you know, went swimming and so on. Yeah. So it was really, really very different. But this was both botany because there were people. And we were equally, you know, just commingled. It was just your major was different. Well, you know that.
And
yeah. So it was very interesting. And it was called biology building, you see.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until Dr. Burge died. And then it immediately switched to Burge Hall. But those first 3 years, it was because he was alive.
Yeah.
I think he died in 1950,
51,
maybe.
I don't remember.
I don't either.
But in the late 40s, he was still coming in.
Yeah, he was retired, but he still came in every day, I remember.
He had this chauffeur. His name was Billy. He was a little rotund guy. And he'd bring him every day at 9:30, and he stayed a couple hours. Mm-hmm. And his office was up on the fourth floor, and that's where we were. Endocrinology was up on the fourth floor by the old elevator. So we would see him, you know. And he was not a pleasant man. Now this I think I can say. He was
I think you're fine.
He was quite brusque and
really, and
so on.
To everyone or just students?
I think to everyone.
Yeah.
To everyone.
Yeah.
That was just his nature. But he was an interesting guy because he had these piercing blue eyes, you know, and here he was at 94 or 95 or whatever. It was amazing. And I guess I told the story at the meetings that my former husband has very poor eyes. And so one time going up in that old rickety elevator, Dr. Burge looked at him and then he poked him, I think, and he said, "Boy, do you have to wear those glasses?"
And what did your husband say?
He said, "I guess yes, unfortunately," or something. He was flabbergasted, you know. He got poked by Dr. Burge and called boy. Do you have to wear those glasses? And here he was, you know, piercing.
You're right.
Oh yeah.
Are there other faculty or administrators from that time who made a particular impression on you?
Well, I also told the story about Dr. Bryant from botany, mm-hmm. who taught 101 in the big zoology. I can't remember what the number is on the zoology building or the auditorium there. Mm-hmm. But he insisted women sit on one side and men sit on the other as long
really?
As he. Yeah, this was in the 40s until he retired.
What was his rationale for that?
I don't know whether he thought they wouldn't pay attention or what, but. Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Quite different.
It sure was. Even in those days, you know, the fact that there were so many of us women around was the beginning of that.
But he had a
what?
Are there other experiences you recall that would be surprising to women today on campus? Thinking about your daily routine or, you know, the academic experience in general, the campus climate.
I think in the 40s, there was so much change and so on. You know, with the men coming back, the GI Bill, getting all of that. There were no research assistantships, you know, mm-hmm. until, what, the end of the 40s, 50s maybe? And when NSF and NIH and all of that stuff began. So I think we were more equal in the 40s than we probably were in the 50s.
No kidding.
So I feel, yeah, and people look at me, yeah, like you, you know, they don't think about it.
Yeah.
But I think the fact that we were there and were established, you know, helped us rather than the ones who came in the 50s, because then the competition was really keen.
Right, but you had the opportunity to put your roots down in the 40s.
We were already there and established, I never had any problems with my peers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether, well, I think that's just who they were, but R.K. Meyer was always a feminist, even,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I had a husband. Nobody was, I mean, that those things kept it. But I don't think that most of my friends had much trouble
mm-hmm.
with those. Some of those things happened later.
Sure. One of the things Mandy and I were interested in hearing your experiences or impressions of is the point at which the soldiers did return to campus and what that climate might have been like for the campus that was established to suddenly experience this influx of men who had just come from, you know, the front lines or had spent many years in very, very different situation, very different conditions. Today we would maybe classify that as PTSD or, you know, other concerns. Was there anything like that on campus, do you recall?
I don't remember any of those incidents, but we were, I at least, because I'd had some experience with it, was aware of epilepsy.
Interesting.
And we had several
mm-hmm.
instances where, you know, we had some fellow had a grand mal attack, and we you know, could take care of him
mm-hmm.
and called the health service, and they'd come,
sure.
come and get them. And I don't know the number of those, but those I remember. But I don't ever remember anybody going off, you know, losing it completely
and
that kind of thing. There was the usual difference, the ones that didn't pay much attention and the ones who were very serious. Most of them were, you know, most of them were there. They'd already wasted 3 or 4 years and they were,
right.
you know, they wanted to get on. So, but I do remember the several times mm-hmm. we had.
Do you recall anything in particular or special that the university may have provided as far as sort of transitional services to help that re-entry into campus life at that time?
I am not very much in to it, if there were, except as I said, the health service was very,
mm-hmm.
very good.
Very good.
They were, and I'm not remembering many instances about the dean of students
mm-hmm.
and that kind
mm-hmm.
of thing,
mm-hmm.
but they were there, I'm sure, and yeah, everybody, everything expanded so fast.
Yeah, a lot of construction, a lot of people on campus.
Exactly.
Population explosion.
Went from, you know, a reasonable size to all of a sudden people just all over, so it was a very sudden.
Sure. How did you feel about that after having been sort of established for a few years?
It was okay.
Yeah.
I was interested in their well, I always been interested in getting people educated. And,
sure.
And they, as I said, most of them were really, really interested. You know, yeah. They were really serious about it. And
yeah.
So that was good. You didn't have the ones that just came because their father had a lot of money. And
slackers.
Yeah. Yeah. We always had some Playboys, but most of them came in the 70s and early 80s and stuff, and they were foreign.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
I don't think I guess I can say the name. We had one fellow, in this is in physiology, so you know it was 72, later in 72, who decided, his name was Pahlevi. Does that mean anything to you? P-A-H-L-E-V-I? That was the Shah.
What?
The Shah of Iran. He was a cousin. Of the Shah. And so he used that, see. He decided that he was not going to take lab. Well, you know, it's a 5-credit course, so he lost 2 out of the 5. And he flunked the course.
Uh-oh.
And he was furious.
Oh, sure.
And he said, well, he couldn't go home. He was going home, and he couldn't do it, you know, with this thing. Well, fortunately, the situation in the, I didn't never did explain this, how the 600 class worked.
Ah, yes.
There were 3 lecturers, usually, 2 or 3 full professors.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were the 2 of us who were in charge of all the labs and discussions and TAs. And then we had, the most I think we ever had was 12 TAs.
Sure.
But then we had up to 19 discussion sections, and I don't know, however many labs.
Mandy's face just went white.
Jeez.
Were, you know, that would go with it. Well, anyway, here was this guy. And fortunately, my department always stuck up for us, you know, against those, that kind of person. Well, I'm so glad we did, because he was around. He was just using that excuse. He was around for 2 or 3 years after that.
But, oh, my.
But, you know, and then there was another one from, this would be earlier because it was in endocrinology, who was from India, and I think he was of the Brahmin caste or something. And RK had them make reviews of endocrinology or blue bits or, you know, various papers. And they were to hand them in every semester. And I graded them all. Well, I don't know how I did it, but this kid, not kid, he was a man, word for word, second semester, what somebody had done first semester.
Uh-oh.
And again, you know, he made a big fuss in the department.
Sure.
Department hung in there, which is good, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there are always those instances, but those, and I should not say pick them out, but they were the ones that I remember, because they were, you know, they were trying to get something for nothing.
Yeah, sure. Milk the system.
Oh,
yeah.
Mandy, perhaps we should jump into some of your questions about graduate women in science and such.
I guess the first question I have is, how did you become involved? Why did you become involved?
Well, that was the organization for women. The men's organization was Gamma Alpha, but even though the women had asked, you know, they wouldn't consider having women.
Mm.
And so Graduate Women in Science was formed on campus, and it, they really were serious about it in those days. They there weren't that many of us, see.
Yeah.
So most everybody belonged, but they had this really complicated thing you had to go through and tell all of the research. It depended on research, so you couldn't do it until you'd done some. Mm-hmm. You showed that you could do research, you know. So that's why I wasn't 46, it was 47 that I joined. And that was the same year I got a master's. So, but they did blackball a few women. Not for their characters or anything, because they thought they were not qualified. They had not done enough research.
Sure.
Well, you know, you don't do that these days. You're right. Glad they have them.
Right, right.
That's right.
But anyway, so it's very serious. And to belong was quite an honor in those days. Mm-hmm. So that was when I made the decision, you know, to join.
Could you describe a little bit about the early years of your participation in the Graduate Women in Science, the organization, the activities,
yeah.
some of the key figures that were in leadership positions?
The meetings were serious. They were sometimes about an individual's research, sometimes a guest person, but always serious. And we had this big initiation banquet. If you finally made it in, you know, in the spring,
yeah.
then, you know, the banquet was always a highlight of the year. I don't know when it happened that in the fall, usually probably late September, maybe early in October, all women in science on campus were invited to a meeting. That was the big thing
mm-hmm.
in the fall. And then told about the organization and, you know, and some refreshments and so on. And that was really trying to recruit people.
Yeah.
That was the thing, although it didn't happen until later, you know, but that was to give them the idea that
sure.
there was such a thing on campus, which in a way was important, you know, because there wasn't,
mm-hmm.
women had always belonged to Phi Beta Kappa, but that was all. They were not eligible for the other. There was another one besides Gamma Alpha, but I can't remember now what it was for men, but, you know, mm-hmm. women were excluded, so
mm-hmm.
so it was important, and it was... I use the word fraternal, which is you know, but it was you sort of developed. Sometimes there was someone who sort of took you under her wing, you know, if you were young and needed,
mm-hmm.
you know, and friendships lasted forever,
mm-hmm.
and it was a very important thing for women. It wasn't something just extraneous that you did if you felt you had the time, but it was vital.
Mm-hmm.
For women to get together in those days. And even earlier, we still had, well, for several years, we had charter members. And one of them was Mrs. Noland,
mm-hmm.
Ruth Noland.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the one who would go clear back and talk about how the men made fun of them and called them, what they call it, something not she Gamma Alpha, but some, you know, some derogatory.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, and so on. And she stayed active, you know, even though she did not do any research after she got married. She was an entomologist,
oh.
which is interesting, you know,
yeah.
back in those days. So we had some interesting people. Eloise Gary, by this time, was not always at the meetings. The one that I remember was Elizabeth McCoy.
Mm-hmm.
And she was there for years, you know. And,
yeah.
What are your sort of memories or impressions at last about Elizabeth McCoy?
She was a very capable researcher.
Mm-hmm.
As I said at the meeting, she always was one of those, like Reagan, you just pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Mm-hmm.
But also like Reagan, she forgot that she had two advantages that a lot of people didn't have. Number one, she was independently wealthy.
Oh, interesting.
Number two, she had for her mentor, E.B. Fred, who was one of the, you know, the great microbiologists,
yeah.
and together they had worked on penicillin during the war, and then she went off on Clostridia and some other things.
Mm-hmm.
But she, once in a while, one of the girls would challenge her. I would hear it, you know, and she She just didn't hear that. She didn't hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we always went out to her farm for picnics as long as she was able. After she retired, she sort of switched to the Academy mm-hmm. of Letters and Sciences. I think she gave them that building, you know where it is on University Avenue, just beyond...
right by the foundation.
Yeah, just beyond the foundation.
We'll drive by it.
I think she bought that building for them, and she spent a lot of time there afterwards. And the really interesting thing about her is that they never could find a will.
No kidding.
And she and her brother didn't get along at all, and he got everything. So nobody knows her. It must be in a book or something, you know.
Tucked away.
Yeah.
But yeah. So that was kind of a.
Yeah. If you look in the, I think in the biofiles at the mm-hmm. archives, there's tons of papers in there related to her estate and how things were divided up.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll look for it in the archives.
but
down in the basement somewhere.
Nobody, you know, and it doesn't make sense that somebody like that would not would not have something. So so where it was, nobody knew. But
she stayed involved as a mentor and a participant for a long time then.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Were there other charter members that were actively involved up until the time of their death?
Well, Eloise Gary was, you know, she was...
Did you interact with her?
No, I did not know her very well at all. Mm-hmm. Edith Jones was an interesting woman. She was a charter member, and she stayed active. Helen Parsons, also, Vitamin B's. But Helen, unfortunately, got shingles.
Mm.
And they never went away. They were on her back, and... You know, it's pain. Well, you don't know, but it's painful. It's painful, I guess. I've had a shot. Thank you very much. She never got over it, and so she couldn't go leave her apartment for the last maybe 5-10 years of her life because she would wear something loose, you know.
Yeah.
But it was sad because she was okay otherwise. So they were some of the originals.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would say the next tier would be the Dickies.
Mm-hmm. And what's your memory or sort of strongest experiences with the Dickies? You're smiling.
Well, I would say they both were my good friends. Mm-hmm. Very different. They were twins, but fraternal twins.
Yeah.
Ruth looked more like her other sisters than she did like Helen. Helen was dark. Their bodies were the same. They were short and squat, you know. But Helen was dark and Ruth was light. And in lots of ways, they were the opposite personality-wise. But if Helen had not been, this is sort of, in a way, like Dr. Burge, you mm-hmm. know, very assertive and so on, very sure of herself. She wouldn't have made it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because she was the first woman, you know, physician, let alone a pulmonologist at the university, you know, she was it. And so that's part of who she was. But she was very short with students.
Mm-hmm.
But they all said that they learned the most from her, you know, even though she was. And I think she really liked them. It was just her way, you know.
Yeah.
And Ruth was the opposite. Ruth was just so, well, she was a nutritionist, you know, mm-hmm. and always provided the food and was concerned about people. And when Helen would do something, she'd try and, you know.
Fix it.
Yeah, smooth it over. Yeah. So it was very interesting. And Ruth was more active.
Mm-hmm.
She and I, you know, were together forever at they joined the same time, mm-hmm. although the record is a little bit fuzzy, but I found mine, you know.
Okay, you found yours?
Now I don't know what I did with it, but I did find it. It said 1947.
Yeah, there's a little booklet of initiates in the archives. Yeah.
And I'm not there.
Yeah, Betty's not in there, but there's a picture of Ruth Dickey in 1948.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we always said 47. So
yeah.
Anyway, I'll try and find it. I don't. I did find it, but I, you know, afterwards.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I wasn't listed. And so Ruth really cared about women. Well, she cared about people, but she cared about women, and she wanted them to have the opportunity to make it, mm-hmm. to do their best. And Helen was with her, but more quietly, you know, and so on. And so Bruce was the one who willed so much money to Jewis.
Yeah.
Both national and
yep.
and Beta.
So you had an opportunity to really, spend a lot of time with some of these women. How do you think they've influenced your trajectory in your career over the years?
Well, certainly going to national meetings broadened my outlook. Mm-hmm. And I guess it made me satisfied with being here. Although, and again, it's okay, I think. The women on both coasts think they've got all the answers, you know. And we in the Midwest are just auxiliary.
I think that's fine to say.
Yeah. And, but on the other hand, I had very good friends among those, especially from Omicron, from the Washington, D.C. area.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. Sister Pat, the nun, you know. And some of those were very good friends. And she was not like that. But some of the others, and the younger ones especially, thought, you know, that they had all the answers, and the rest of us were just, you know, we just didn't know. We were fluff, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know what they do now with stem cell stuff all originating here, but anyway.
they eat crow.
yeah. So that, in lots of ways, it was interesting. And I learned some things sociologically also. The women on the East Coast are heavy drinkers.
Oh. More so than Wisconsin.
Yes.
Wow.
The women that I went with to the meetings did not drink much.
Mm-hmm.
Ruth was, well, neither Helen either. They were not much drinkers. Maybe one, you know, one glass of wine. But the women from the East Coast, and it was kind of fun because it was like living in a dorm again. You know, mm-hmm. You would go, and they always had bottles. after the other stuff was over, and you were invited, you know, to their room for a bottle. But they were the ones who were the heavy drinkers, which I was, in a way, was interesting. But
yeah, sure.
It showed the difference.
Yeah.
Another thing I learned, of course, is that most of the chapters are gone. By that I mean they are associated with a university or universities or something. Even the Omicron, which also has a lot of other people. The big example of the one where it's town is Zai, is Minnesota.
Yep.
Interesting.
Where they, you know, but they've got a lot of big companies there.
Yeah.
And so that was something that also you would notice, and especially when you would, the meeting was at their, you know, at their particular place, you would notice that kind of thing. But again, it was fine. I was always glad. But again, I was always glad to come back.
Yeah.
I think it's a good mix here, you know. Mm-hmm. I've always been.
Did you ever consider leaving academia for a position in the private sector?
Not really.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I could have done that without jeopardizing my son's, you know, I was pretty much, it was the last 20 years, and I was happy.
Yeah.
So I didn't, once in a while I thought about it, you know. Would I rather be doing some consulting, some doing, you know, because that kind of stuff didn't come along until about the 90s either,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's very true.
So
choices.
So as far as when I made the decision not to do really serious research, I think I limited myself, but on the other hand, I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so it worked out very well.
That's true.
Yeah.
So one question I had is that I've noticed that, like you talked about Ruth Noland and how she, after she was married, she didn't really continue to do a lot of science. And I've also noticed that a lot of the women who were more prominent, like Elizabeth McCoy mm-hmm. and Eloise Gary, never married. So did you see that a lot where, you know, once a woman got married, she kind of, you know, fell out of science? Did you find that just a lot of those women just didn't get married, or did a lot of women find a way to have a balance?
I think of that original group. You're right, it was either or. Well, Edith Jones managed to have a family and still do it, but the rest of them were mostly single.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And I don't know whether Ruth Noland, I suspect she did it to, she was so conscientious, she probably did it to be a good mother, you know, thinking,
mm-hmm. right.
Mm-hmm. thinking that in those days you had to be home to be a good mother. I suspect never entered her mind, you know, really.
Right.
Did you feel a lot of societal or community pressure to do that, to maybe spend a less amount of time or effort or energy on your career and focus on a family?
Well, again, everybody that I worked for or with, whatever, was very understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Very understanding about that. I don't think so. The only concession that I made to that was when I went over to physiology, they asked me, do you want a 12-month or a 9-month appointment?
Mm.
And I took the 9 months because my youngest son, and by this time I was a single mother.
Mm-hmm.
I'll talk to you about that in a minute. So I was happy to be home with him in the summer. Now, I always had less money, you know,
yeah, right.
But I've never been sorry. And even after he got older, I liked it, you know.
Yeah.
I traveled and I just planned on it, and it worked out well.
Yeah.
So I did not have any problems,
mm-hmm.
and nobody ever, you know, said anything about, well, why aren't you home, or you should spend more time here, you know. They left it up to me to make the decisions, and it worked out well. The only problem I had was, in those days, it was called a broken home.
Mm-hmm.
And the counselor up at West always said that to me. He said, Mark is doing so well coming from a broken home.
Ugh.
And I used to get so irritated. And I would say to him almost every time, come on now, a broken home is when you've got two people at odds and fighting. I said, if you have a home where there is one person the kid can depend on,
mm-hmm.
I said, it isn't a broken home. Well, maybe, he'd say. And then we'd go through it the next time. And I understand that guy did that until he retired. So my taxpayer money was paying for him, to do that to women. So that was one of the, well, you know, it didn't happen very often and
sure.
so on. But that was one of the one that I remember the most
about
being a single parent and so on.
How common was it to be a single parent at that time?
Not very.
Mm. When was it that you...
68.
68.
Oh, okay.
So
getting more common, but still not...
It was the first in families.
Yeah.
And it was very... In a way, it was hard on my mother.
Sure.
And people in that little town, you know, how people are. They can't keep quiet. I always said, if you can't say something good, then don't say anything. But they would say to her, you know, well, why doesn't Betty get married again? You know, mm-hmm. And it took my mother 10 years before she could say, because she doesn't want to. Mm-hmm. And then after that, everything was fine. You know.
Yeah.
But it was hard on my mother.
Yeah. Were there other women, you know, in GWIS or that were associated with you on campus that were going through a similar situation?
I never felt isolated or conspicuous, mm-hmm. so there must have been, but I don't,
I don't,
you know, I'm not thinking about anybody in particular at this time, but it was beginning to be, I think, maybe more so in academia than in the general public, you know.
I'm intrigued.
Because women began to have more careers, they, you know,
yeah.
If there are problems, you know, then it accentuates them, right?
Yeah, right.
Which is, yeah, the way it happened.
So how did that period of time in general influence you and what was going on with GWIS and women on campus? So, you know, by the late 60s, you have, you know, a real animated women's rights movement, yeah. And you have a lot of changes going on for women in general in the United States.
It's very slow.
Like? Really?
Very slow on campus. We had two things I belonged and chaired eventually. In the medical school, it was called the Commission on Women. Mm-hmm. And that let everything, you know, that was terrible. Because they called it COW, see?
Oh.
And afterwards, they changed it to Commission on Women's Issues.
Oh, no.
But that was pretty important because we were working on, well, Mary Rouse and I was Gina Women, but she and I got the first child care on the Ag campus? Well, it was out there anyway. And the interesting thing was that there were two buildings, prefabs, mm-hmm. had been made by Forest Products mm-hmm. in the 60s. They were the first prefabs in the whole country. And Eleanor Roosevelt had come and dedicated them. And there was a plaque on each one. And we could change the inside, but we couldn't change the outside of those buildings.
Interesting.
Now they're gone, pharmacy.
Yeah, yep.
I don't know what these things get gone.
Right.
But that was one thing we were working on because there wasn't anything on campus for decent childcare, and that's important.
It is.
If you think your child is well taken care of, you know, you're at ease. If you're worried, it has quite an effect. So, we did that, and then later on, we did the third was it? Preschool lab from the what do they call it, the home ec?
School of Human Ecology.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Over in it was, at that time it was my church. It was on the corner of University and Charter, second floor. And that,
okay.
They had that child care there.
Is that still there? The University Avenue Discovery Center.
No. This is a little farther east. There is a church there still.
Oh, I'd have to look again.
Yeah. It's surrounded by chemistry.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, chemistry. Yeah,
and when they put in one of those last chemistry buildings, and they had to get rid of that.
Yep.
You know, there. And
so
it went out to Bethany Church on out here. But anyway, we worked on that kind of thing. But as far as women, things were not good, mm-hmm. you know. So there was a sexual harassment policy committee on campus, and I chaired it for a couple of years. And we would we knew for a long time certain things were happening, but no woman would come forth because, you know, she was afraid for her job.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things?
Well,
comments.
Comments more than comments.
Okay.
So one young woman, well, she was a grad student, was so upset that she even went to Senator Proxmire. Have you heard of Bill Proxmire?
Yeah.
Now, he was not good on women's issues, but in this case, he was okay because he said, I can't do anything. There's no law.
Yeah.
There's no law. But what she was saying is that this fellow, and it's public, it's out there.
Sure.
At the Weizmann Center.
Mm-hmm.
There were two of them, the director and the, I guess it was associate director. They were keeping an apartment on federal funds for women. And what she was going to Proxmire about and to me about was that he was taking this gal to meetings,
mm-hmm.
you know, and she didn't have, she wasn't giving a paper or anything
right.
on NIH funds. I think it was NIH funds. Well, took a long time. All of us knew that were interested in it, you know, knew for years, finally got them. And they served time.
No kidding.
Wow.
They finally did, both of them. And the director then retired, and he had a whole bunch of Arabian horses. You know damn well he got those from.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Also on funds, and nobody bothered to do anything about that. But anyway, then he died young. And then we had one he had a joint appointment with physiology and something else, and everybody knew that he was cheating, you know. And when they confronted him finally, what you find is, or I have, that they are amoral. They will be false in all of their activities. And they couldn't, I didn't tell you the rest of the story with those guys that went to prison. He had a 10-year research something or other he was doing with children at the Weizmann mm-hmm. Center from Milwaukee, and he kept putting it off and delaying with a report. Mm-hmm. And finally they found out he didn't have any report. Yeah, so they cheat, you know, sexually, they cheat on their, you know, on their
accountability,
yeah.
Their research, and they cheat on funds.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what's left?
Yeah.
But who suffers?
Yeah, students.
The wife.
Yeah.
And the kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
This one from our department who was working on Lake Michigan and PCBs, I think. As soon as it came out, his wife retired. You know.
Yeah.
Resigned.
Yeah.
He kept coming into the department until he was. I mean, it's amazing.
That's
it's just
incredible.
They are above. I mean, those people are above the law, and you see it in you know, in other areas. But
yeah.
But they are. It's just that they're above. They're,
do you feel like your committee made progress? Do you feel like the
yes,
work you did
yes.
actually
so
pushed?
What? So what? We got a few of those things, but not just us did it. But we would have complaints like there was a guy in pathology who in the middle of his lecture would show a slide of a woman naked to the waist with a butterfly net. Had absolutely nothing to do with, you know, what he was talking about.
Sure.
And he admitted it was to get their attention. And I went over and over and over with that guy that it was not something that he should be doing, you know.
Right.
Well, it takes a long time to get those things, but eventually those things we did get them worked out. And I will say this, that the administration was always there.
Mm-hmm.
When I would finally get to the you know, to the administration, I think I said at the meeting, you weren't there, were you?
Mm-mm.
At the meeting, I don't know how I got into it, but one of the girls came to me and said, Betty, do I have to look at the Sports Illustrated bathing suit? They were all around the mailroom, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And some people say, well, just don't go to the mailroom. Well, of course you've got to go. Somebody's
right.
got to go to the mailroom.
Right.
Why shouldn't she be able to go to the mailroom? And so I went to the administration of the medical school, and they get them down. Now, I made an enemy of
sure.
the guy,
sure.
you know? And I tried to talk to him. I said, why don't you put it in your rec room at home?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so some of those things. And the one positive thing that we did, we spent a lot of time on it, and this was early on. We were one of the earliest ones. We did come up with a good statement on consensual relationships, because that's a very... That's a very difficult thing, and I sent those out all over the country for quite a while.
What year was that, do you remember? Or roughly?
Does 85 sound right?
It could.
I think in some of the items in the archives, yeah, 1982 is 1 year. I know you were on that committee, that there was some stuff in there. So
okay, well,
it was in that
one
time
of those,
period.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
yeah, the early 80s.
Yeah, and then there were you know, some other guys with slides and... Oh, and the other thing which and I don't know if it ever got settled, was, you know, the 12 cranial nerves on old Olympus's towering tops, a Finn and German viewed some hops, and there is a vulgar one that the anatomy department would say, and they were doing it while they were working on cadavers. Well, you know,
right.
Now there are more women than men, but they're
right.
It didn't make any difference. They
right.
They continue to do it. And these are supposedly, in quote, good God-fearing men who just don't
right.
understand.
Right.
Just don't understand. So those are some of the things. So GWAS was not working toward women in getting, you know, tenure and that kind of stuff. In a vacuum,
right.
this we were working on this other stuff at the same time.
And I think the fact that many of you were involved in these other committees and could bring those issues together and
yeah.
view it, you know, through a different perspective as well was probably critical.
One woman who was very, very good in that respect was Bernice Durand. Have you heard of her?
From physics.
Yeah, she stayed a member of GWAS all that time, and she was active. And of course, you know, she had academic positions afterwards, always mm-hmm. was there for women. But she had a terrible time when she first came, you know, in the physics department.
She the first woman mm-hmm. in the department?
And the only reason she was there was that she married.
Oh.
And so she had, you know, she had a lot of trouble. So she was always very, very sensitive, very helpful.
Mm-hmm. How was that for women who were faculty hires at that time? What was the climate like? Spousal hires.
Physics was way behind. I think zoology and botany did better. Chemistry was sort of intermediate, but some of those women from chemistry are still here.
Mm-hmm.
They're good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We had one in physiology who was really good, and the department okayed her. But then, you know, you go to the biological division,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't. And sometimes people fought.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, it's not worth it. She says, if you win, you lose.
Mm-hmm.
And so she left. And I thought that was, you know, that was a real loss for the department. So it wasn't easy.
Yeah.
It wasn't easy. There was one in zoology who left and went to, I think, the University of Minnesota, but kept fighting, trying to get tenure in zoology.
Was that, I think, Namenworth or something
yes,
like that?
Miriam, Namenworth.
Yes, yes. I was actually wondering about that, because there's a lawsuit went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
Yep.
And in part of that, in the testimony, they talked about Nellie Bilstad, who was a member of GWAS. And so I was wondering, I mean, what was her experience? Because it sounded like it took a long time for her to reach...
Nellie?
Yeah.
Oh, she was much... And I suspect she always got less money than the men.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like.
This was
substantially
it. And we
less.
Had one in physiology who... Her name was Eleanor Larson. She came as an assistant professor in... I want to say 1942. It was... And she... Someplace along in there, it was almost 30 years, and she left in 70-something, still an assistant professor. Well, now I don't know how they did it, because you're really supposed to, you know, move up or leave.
Right.
But they left Eleanor, and her problem was they took her too lightly. Now, she was one of the few examples, I think, that physiology goofed. Otherwise, physiology was way ahead of some of the other departments, I think. I wouldn't have... they let me do my thing, you know.
Yeah.
Some of them are Well, you know, the most conservative combination is an MD and a PhD. And I'm sure they didn't like what I did, but they always let me do it.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm grateful. But those things happen. Yeah. There was Eleanor. And she had a happy ending, though. She went down to Capitol Lakes. It wasn't called that at the time. And she found a man. Really? And she wore her hair up, you know, real tight. Sometimes your eyebrows are up, you know. And a braid around here. Well, she started wearing fancy colored scarves, and she had a really nice end to her life. I thought it was wonderful.
That's lovely. That is.
Funny. Yeah. Then the other one who was a pioneer, and I don't see how you can miss it, is Denise Denton, engineering.
Yeah, there's a lecture series on campus every
for
time.
Her.
For her. In yep. the name, yeah.
And she, you know, she fought like she finally got it, tenure and so on. But she had some personal problems. Anyway, she took her own life when she was out in,
That's
where
tragic.
Was it? USC or one of them. One of them out there.
I remember where she had gone to.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that she had committed suicide.
Yeah. It's very sad. We all felt terrible about it. After all the, you know, the fighting she'd done. And
sure.
Yeah. So it's not been easy for some people.
No.
Some of us have had it easier. And then there are people like Molly Carnes, you know, who's done... Things just seem to fall in place for Molly and some others. So it's been a mixed bag. But
how do you feel the experience is different for women today? So from your perspective, you know, Mandy, as a graduate student, as a future faculty member, compared to your experience?
I don't know how much... You have some advantages, I think. But I don't know how much because I'm not really that close to you anymore. But it looks better. Although I think there is a tendency for especially mothers, and I could kick them, to tell girls to get an MRS rather than to go on. You know, it's scary.
Yeah.
Because whether or not you marry and whether or not you have children, 90% of women are going to have to work. So you might as well get something that you like and that gives you a decent wage, right?
Mm-hmm. Something to fall back on, too.
And so I see that, and it bothers me a lot. But
yeah, and that I haven't seen that as much, but I know I took a class last semester actually taught by Molly Carnes.
Yeah.
And, you know, about women in leadership. And, you know, hearing stories from some of the women in that class, there definitely are some cases of discrimination out there.
Oh, yeah.
That you sit back and it's shocking, you know, to think that, you know, people I know, people at this university.
At this time
are still facing some of those obstacles. They're certainly not what they used to be.
No.
But they're still out there.
So that's why we have to keep working, you know. I mean.
Yeah.
At least I think in that case we're not going backwards, but in some instances we are, you know. I'm worried about women's rights in other areas, health areas, and so on. You know, some of the stuff I've been working on all my life is going backwards. But
it's interesting, and I think we interviewed the Mandy's group, the Graduate Women in Science Leadership Group that organized the conference, and some of the issues that you were talking about seem similar, but they're maybe more under cover. They're a little bit harder
more
to
subtle.
See.
They're subtle. Yeah.
And I think the interviewing process was one topic we talked about. The lack of, well, I can't remember how to phrase it, but the fact that you may be the only woman in your department, and now that the university is so large, how do you network and find that group that really provides that mentoring? And
so that's why GWAS is still needed.
Yes. Unfortunately, it's harder
I think harder
yes.
for people to find it.
Exactly.
Because it's not, there. You know, there's so many organizations on campus.
Right.
And so many opportunities.
Yeah, that it kind of can get a little bit lost. But I think it still serves a lot of the same purpose in terms of just giving people that support group, you know, and a different venue to kind of be with other women in science.
Let me ask you a question. How successful, how do you think Ruth Dickey's fellowships help?
Immensely. I didn't realize how much of
okay.
a difference it makes until at the conference we had three past winners of not necessarily just her scholarship, but some of the other fellowships as well from GWAS come.
From
and
national, though.
They were at the national level, but I think that at the Ruth Dickey level, it's a smaller amount,
right?
But it still certainly makes a difference.
Because she was so, you know, so desperately wanted that.
Yeah.
And I said that I think it's too bad that the women who receive those fellowships only stay a member of GWAS long enough to
right.
get the fellowship.
In some cases, yes. But
so that's a job
yeah.
that should be done to try to keep them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, and in terms of the national fellowships, which are tend to be larger dollar amounts, we had the three people we had come to the conference, basically they couldn't have done their research
right.
without that money.
Right.
I mean, it was that critical
that's great.
To them being able to get their degree.
Yeah.
And the Ruth Dickey, I don't think is quite the same, but it gives them, I know, you know, easier times getting supplies, going to travel for conference or, you know, anything like that. So
well, I
makes
hope
a difference.
So because she really, you know, really
yeah.
dear to
helps.
Her heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, one of the original ones was Eloise Gary
yeah.
and hers is still.
Yeah, hers is very large.
It's a big one. And
yeah.
$100,000 was a lot in those days.
Yeah.
Still
well,
lot.
And it's
yeah.
still a lot and it's grown. Mm.
Yeah,
you know, since
because you can only
just,
use the
yeah, basically using the interest and yeah. No, that stuff has definitely made a difference.
Okay, because I think about it, you know, she mattered so much to her.
Yeah, it definitely has helped.
I feel like the students who are awarded the Dickey money should have to spend a couple of hours in the archives researching Ruth and learning more about
yes.
her life and maybe listening to this interview and really gaining an appreciation for her passion for women students in academia.
Yeah.
Something like that would be really interesting, maybe.
That would be, actually.
Yeah. I'd help you with that.
As it is, we have you know, just basically a seminar every year for the winners of the Ruth Dickey, just locally,
okay.
that they come and just give a presentation about their research. So we can see,
but do
you know,
where
it's being spent.
But you don't necessarily discuss the source.
No, that's on the application form, but you're right. I think it's, you know, I think we're getting more
some anecdotes.
Yeah.
And I like the
definitely.
Idea of some way to keep someone's legacy alive
yeah.
through, you know, even if it's just sharing, you know, a brochure that we create about Ruth or, you know, invite people to the archives to see her collection.
Yeah.
You know, that would be a neat activity. So I'm wondering, as we're talking, Betty, as you look back on your career, is there anything that you wish you would have done? Is there something that you had hoped to accomplish that you didn't get to, or that through the course of decisions, life took you in a different direction academically?
I always, as a teacher, I think we're geared for the middle student.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We don't have time to really pull the F student up.
Mm-hmm.
They need more than we can do. We can maybe get the C student up to a B, and maybe the B to an A. But we don't do much for this guy with the F, and we don't do as much as we should for the guy with the A.
Yeah.
Or the girl with the A. And I always thought that I would like to have a seminar, maybe two or three times a year, that would be for these A students in physiology, you know, and have one of the profs, because I know several of them would be very interested in talking to them, and maybe have them read the paper or read something beforehand and then have it. I was always sorry I didn't have time to do that.
Yeah.
because I think that would have been helpful. It would, if they were wondering at all about research, that would be, that would be a beginning, you know?
Yeah.
And I never did that, but otherwise, I think, I hope I helped, you know, a little, help kids a little bit. For example, in lab, sometimes, I mentioned this also, I remember one woman in particular, but there have been several over the years who would get really swollen, you know, premenstrual tension.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this was before we had a name for that,
right,
too,
right,
you know.
Right, right.
And they would come in, and one of them, it was so bad that her little fingers were like sausages. She could hardly hold a forceps. She could, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so she would ask me, and I don't know if she had been over to the health services or not, but the only thing I knew was to say, limit salt, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there were several of them who were like that. She was the worst, you know. But maybe you can offer that. We had, through the years, I had opportunities to help several who had been raped, offer. I was older by that time, you know. I was like a mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could offer help for those kind of things. So, yeah, there have been some rewards other than...
Yeah. That's a heavy topic for a student to come to you with.
I would find out, you know, they were really teary or really, you know, all withdrawn and so on. And one of them, it was her roommate who blamed her for it. And so that was really difficult, you know. That's what made it so hard for her.
Yeah.
I don't remember how I found out, but...
And at the time, there was probably not a service or resource on campus to deal with something specifically.
Not something specific like there is now. My granddaughter works for domestic abuse, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you do what you can, you know. I'm trying to think if there were any. And then with our TAs, they've had problems, some of them sometimes. And I remember being, you know, just being there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, I never did find out what was wrong, but we knew that there was a problem between him and his wife, and so I simply said that. I said, I don't know, and I don't need to know, but I said, I want you to know that I'm thinking about you. And he, you know, you can do a few little things like that.
Yeah.
In addition to the strictly academic.
One other sort of general question I have for you. You mentioned, women or mothers these days encouraging their daughters just to go for the MRS degree. What do you see as being the best thing that parents or mentors or educators can do to get more young women interested in the sciences and mathematics and medicine and computer science? How do we continue to push that?
It's very difficult because if you, as a parent, don't know anything about them,
mm-hmm.
the sciences, then you're treading in deep water when you try. I think one of the things is our expanding your horizons,
mm-hmm.
which I think really, really helps.
Can you talk a little bit about that program just for a moment?
I'm very, very proud of that.
I can tell.
It started in 1959,
mm-hmm.
and it was just three high schools. I guess that's all there were in town at the time. Central, there was one on campus.
Wisconsin High School.
Wisconsin High School.
And West?
West.
West and East, I think. Or maybe it was Central.
Maybe just Central at that time.
Central, West, and, well, anyway.
Yeah.
And at that time, you could hire students for the summer. We did this in zoology for quite a while. You know, they could do the menial stuff. And so we had those girls come to on campus and look at labs, and then they spent the summer, you know, in a lab. Well, that was fine. There were 20 of them, I think, or mm-hmm. something like that. You can handle that easily.
Sure.
And then you had to add the other high schools as they came along. And it was soon decided, well, seniors are too late. You can't do anything for them, you know. So it would go down to juniors and then sophomores and I think all high school students. And we began to put more of the high schools in. And I think it wasn't until probably we had the big break that we really switched to junior, you know, to middle school kids, thinking that they were the ones that really, really can profit the most from it. But at first we had science and math. And then we added engineering, and we got a lot of help from them. They were really great.
Yeah.
They gave us secretarial help and committee help and all kinds of stuff. And then I guess you know that in 86 and 87, we didn't have it. I couldn't find anybody to do it.
No kidding.
Really? Everybody I went to, Phil Certain was dean, on down. Everybody said, oh, it's a wonderful program, should continue. But we needed a place, you know, for and secretarial help and so on. And it took those 2 years to get that going again. And then we sort of changed. We went out to the community.
Okay.
We had at that first year we had now conked out, but we had and then Girl Scouts came and you know, and various things that make sense, you know, and keep the thing going. So I'm happy now. I think it'll continue. But those couple of years, I spent a lot of time going around trying to find some.
Do you feel like the experience made a difference for the women that participated?
Say it does.
Did you ever find any of them showing up in one of your classes later in college?
I did not. Mm-hmm. I did not. I don't know that anybody did, but.
Now, didn't you say that you had grandchildren go through the program? I don't know how old they are now, but
21 is the youngest.
Mm-hmm. I mean, have they ever said anything to you about it?
Oh yeah,
they all thought it was.
Yeah, they all thought it was worthwhile.
Yeah.
I don't know that any of them. Well, none of them's gone into science. Well, yes, they have. Yes, they have. My next to youngest granddaughter is in marine biology at Hawaii.
Yeah,
but I don't think I had much influence on that. She, from the time she was 8 or 9, she wanted to be a marine biologist.
Wow.
And she, you know, most kids change their minds a million times, but she hung in there with it. Yeah.
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 Well, it's a great program.
Yeah, and so I stayed until that 50th. They celebrated the 50th.
Oh, sure.
So
59 to
in
2009.
Yeah, 2009.
2009.
And then I went off the committee.
Sure.
At first I was just going to stay until the last of my granddaughters was through, but then I stayed till it.
That's neat.
So you served, you were involved with it every year then from
Not every year, but I was there, you know.
Right.
I knew about it. Some years I had more than others.
Right.
And in the 60s, a couple of times I did it alone, and I even did the food, you know.
Oh, wow.
We only had a small number, and we would have it in one of the penthouse, you know, McArdle or biochemistry or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. But there would only be 50 girls, maybe.
That's still quite a lot to
handle.
Well, yeah. But anyway,
it was worth it.
And I think the interesting thing about this is, in all those years, only one woman ever asked about being paid.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
And of course, I dropped her. But I think that's interesting, and it involves maybe up to 100 women, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so when people say, oh, it ought to be a weekend, you'd ought to do it twice a year, you know, all of this kind of stuff, it would be wonderful if you could. But that's the reason not, you know.
Right.
The minute it's over, they evaluate, and then they start planning
start for the next,
for the next year.
Sure.
So does the university now give more money? Or
yes,
like,
most
like
of the schools, most of the colleges do give now.
Is that run through Wisely or?
No.
Who sort of governs or oversees the program now?
Well, it was always GWIS. I don't know
who's
doing it now.
The one time that I've worked with it, it was, I think, Brooke Norstad.
Okay.
Was kind of the main contact person. She is over in the Geology Museum.
I see.
Heather Graham has been, Heather, oh, you know who I mean.
I know who you mean.
Academic staff.
Heather, she was in library school with me.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
We'll take that part out.
Daniels, is it?
Yes.
Okay.
We love Heather. We just can't remember her name.
Yeah, Heather Daniels. Anyway, she has been sort of keeping an eye on it.
She's an advocate. I mean, if I think of one person, I mean, there are many on campus, obviously, and GWIS is in particular, but another person on campus who's really carrying the torch forward for women on campus, I think Heather is one of many, but jumps out as somebody who's really taken a leadership role in different groups and advocating on behalf of women. So I think, Betty, I'm wondering if there's anything that you would like to talk about that we haven't asked you about yet. Something that you expected we would ask and haven't, or a piece of your past that is particularly important to you that you haven't shared yet.
No, I think not, except you can have a family.
Mm-hmm.
I have three sons, 7 grandchildren.
Oh my.
And 13 great-grandchildren.
Congratulations.
And you know, the great-grandchildren are just a bonus. I just never thought about anything like that, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's great.
Did any of your sons go into sciences?
No, isn't that interesting?
It is.
Yeah.
Skips a generation, maybe.
One of them should have, but he said he couldn't stand the undergrad stuff to get to vet school. He knows everything there is to know about animals, but he uses it as an avocation. And and the third one, the one, you know, who's really my kid, and I hope that darn counselor knows. He's the one who has Barnes Inc., the landscape.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I've seen those trucks around.
He started, really, mowing lawn and stuff. I loaned him money for a lawnmower and a Toro for a woman. She was 2 houses down.
No kidding.
And he started this neighborhood.
He's all
and,
over this neighborhood.
Oh, he's all over town. He's in 7 figures now, after 30 years.
That's impressive.
But anyway, I hope that darn guy, you know, he's doing so well coming from a broken home, you know.
Right.
not that you measure a life by money, but
he's
a very good employer.
Fair.
For women-wise.
Yeah.
He does have some women, you know, working for him.
Yeah.
And he has stopped working for a couple of families who have given the girls hard time.
Interesting.
He said they can't say anything, but he said, I sure can.
Yeah.
Of course, he has a very strong wife. She took physiology.
There you go.
Yeah.
And he's a fabulous role model.
Two daughters, you know. So, but all three of my sons, I didn't have to do much. I guess you don't, you know, if you're an example. But they're all good, strong.
That's great.
Feminist.
Yeah.
Good men. Period.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an important thing.
It is.
I'm very. Well, you know, as I look back, it's pretty good.
Yeah. Are you still involved with the university besides GWIS?
No.
No. That's really your only connection at this point.
I do go to luncheons once in a while.
Yep.
And my former department chair spoke this summer.
Who is that?
Rick Moss.
Oh.
He's a wonderful guy. Mm-hmm. He was very supportive always. And so I went, and I just sort of stood there in the back, and he was, of course, down in front because he was getting ready to lecture. And he came back, and and I put up my hand, and that was fine, and then he hugged me.
That's great.
Yeah, so that's that great. Was nice. That was just this summer, so.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So nothing official, but you still kind of are around.
Yeah, and every once in a while somebody calls, you know.
Yeah.
Sure. It's hard not to be around when you're just a few blocks away, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
It's always there.
Yep.
Yeah.
There. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's just that my experiences in general were good. I struggled with these, you know, the sexual harassment stuff and the disregard for women, but otherwise. And academically, the department was good, as you know.
All right.
Yeah.
I think that's all the official questions I had. If there's anything else, Mandy, that you wanted to ask about.
So one question I have is, it's the 40th anniversary of Title IX. And I don't know, do you remember if there were many changes on campus at that time period?
Not immediately.
Again, slow.
Slow changes.
They dragging their feet.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and one thing that people have not forgiven is the fact that baseball went for Title IX.
And I heard an earful.
Yeah.
That.
Well, you know, part of it is I'm a great baseball fan. I'm going over to watch the Brewers next week, but baseball in this climate is not very good.
Yeah.
You know, and especially when they pushed commencement up to the middle of May.
Yeah.
You know, so of all the things they got rid of, that, but of course it was very popular.
Sure,
and so,
sure.
But it must have been hard because Richter, you know, played baseball, so it was hard for him to make that decision.
I bet. Yeah.
But I don't think, even with all the money they have now, that they'll go back
no.
to
no.
it.
I don't think so. Although we hear from plenty of people in the archives that are waiting for that day.
I know. I know. Yeah. No, it was quite slow and deliberate. In fact, it was so slow that I think it sort of sneaked in, you know. That stuck out.
Yeah.
But when they had to get rid of three sports, fencing, I think that's unfortunate because stuff that's unusual, you know.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
And we always had a good fencing team.
Badminton, I think we lost badminton at that time.
Yeah, and those things don't cost much. Yeah.
No.
You know. But as far as women are concerned, I think it's been great, you know.
That reminds me to ask you, too, about the sort of anti-war, a lot of the protest activity that was going on in the late 60s and early 70s. Were you involved in any of those activities? Did you, what was your interaction with any of that or experience on campus during that time?
The zoology department was very supportive of the anti-movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally marched with this youngest son of mine. That's why his degree was, he hasn't finished, but he's going back to school.
Oh,
but,
good for him. Yeah.
In poli-sci, you know, instead
great.
Of, but
yeah.
but he marched with me.
Yeah.
And so on. And the only time that I ever, that's Barnes Inc.
That's
doing
great.
The lawn. The only time that I ever had tear gas was one time in Zoll Research, would you believe?
You were in the building.
And it got in the duct, you know.
Yeah. What did you do physically to protect yourself, or were you wearing a mask?
No, because it was completely unexpected.
Sure.
Yeah.
It was.
Sure.
Yeah, it was very strange.
Yeah.
But when we would march, and we either would start at the at Camp Randall or on State Street,
sure,
people would say they're going to trash. And there wasn't a thing we could do about it. But when you were marching along, there were people of all ages,
yeah,
you know, all persuasions.
Yeah.
It was really a very, those kind of marches are very, very uplifting.
Very powerful.
They are. And so we would march down. Usually Mark and I didn't stay for the speeches and stuff. But by the time we got back, you know, it had happened.
Interesting.
Somebody had smashed some windows.
Yeah.
And the problem is, you know, they're cowards.
Yeah.
They hide behind the crowd.
Yeah.
And if their friends are not going to rat on them, nobody knows, you know. And everybody gets the blame.
Yeah.
It's like all of us are going to get the blame for the thing that happened in Oak Creek.
Yeah.
You know?
Did you ever at any time feel afraid or nervous about the violence escalating or a situation getting out of hand?
No, and I was not there when they had the real thing.
The Dow?
Yeah, I did not go for that. But the day that the National Guard came, I was in Dole Research, but our seminar was in Burge. So I had to go across University Avenue, and the National Guard was all lined up on both sides of the street.
What was that like?
With bayonets.
Oh, wow.
That this was the first.
Yeah.
And I said to somebody as we went across, I said, something's going to happen, you know. All you need is somebody to push somebody, and that would, well, anyway. The seminar was an hour, and then I had to see somebody, so it was probably 2 hours. The bayonets were gone.
Interesting.
Somebody had enough sense. But you know, every picture you saw showed those bayonets?
Yeah.
They were only there for an hour or so, it didn't make any difference. That's what everybody looked at. But thank heaven somebody had enough sense to get rid of those.
Did that activity in general ever impact your day-to-day or your research in other ways?
No.
Did it obstruct you or?
No, and my church was there. So when they would have some problem someplace, we would let people use some of our space for classrooms.
Sure.
We did that, was all. Mm-hmm. Oh, and the day of the explosion, you know.
Yeah. The Sterling Hall bomb.
You see, because the church is right there.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Just down the street there, yeah.
Right across.
Yeah.
All of the windows either imploded or exploded.
Oh wow.
And the frames, some of them are still a little crooked after all. Couldn't fix them.
That is, yeah.
The force of that explosion was phenomenal.
I heard it here.
Really?
And
did you think it was?
We knew what it was.
Yeah.
One of my sons, number two, was woke up.
Yeah.
Mark didn't, but Craig said, you know, that was an explosion. So then we turned on the radio and.
Mm-hmm. Sure enough.
Yeah.
What was the climate on campus like immediately after that?
Very sober.
Yeah.
Very sober. And it was interesting that Burge was affected, of course, because Burge was, you know, that one end was. Seriously damaged. I went over to take a look, and that was the last day that I ever saw the fellow who had just gotten the Nobel laureate, and he left. And I will tell you about that in a moment. I'm blanking on his name.
Tiemann?
Indian.
Oh, Hargobind Khorana.
Yeah, you know who I mean.
Yeah, I do. Sorry.
Yeah.
Khorana.
And he took all his people and went to Johns Hopkins or someplace.
Wow.
Because, I tell you, people are so stupid. In the paper, it lists salaries.
Mm-hmm.
It's public knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, his salary at that time was a little over $100,000.
Sure.
And one of the state senators, and I know it's Freudian that I don't remember his name, but he jumped on that and couldn't let go of that, that this guy got over $100,000. Not having enough brains to realize what having a Nobel laureate means, right?
Right.
Well, he couldn't stand it. He,
he
left.
Interesting.
So that was the last day I ever saw him.
Wow.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Some of those things. So, yeah, that was a very sober time, and the climate changed, you know, on campus. We got very, very quiet after that.
Yeah.
All of the real activities ceased.
So what, did the university have any, I don't know, policies, or did they say anything about faculty like you participating in
marches?
No,
I think they let departments do it.
Okay. And your department didn't really...
Most of the department was...
Was there.
Yeah. I remember one time there was a thing on University Avenue, and we sort of went round and round and round, but it was at dinner time, so we blocked traffic, and there were several of our faculty there, you know.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, it is.
It's a little bit different now.
Yeah, I can't imagine them... the university not saying something to faculty about not getting involved and
or do it on your own time.
Right, not in the middle of the day and
they're so careful, so
not stepping on toes.
Yeah.
All for money, right?
Yeah. Well,
all for
I think that's some of it.
Some of it, yeah.
Yeah. Can't even talk about it at work. Can't talk about elections, can't talk about politics, can't...
Well, you certainly can't send anything...
No.
Oh, no.
If you're stupid enough to do that, you're out.
Right.
That's
very true.
Well,
it's
amazing.
We're good. We have about an hour and 45 minutes of you, which is great. There's a few things that we can... do if there are stories or memories that occur to you that we haven't talked about today, you know, we're happy to do a follow-up interview, or we also have a phone number that you can call after hours and leave a story on an answering machine. It's actually just Troy's, our oral historian, set up his office phone to do that, and he's had a lot of participants follow up in that way.
That's really smart.
It is, because I think after you've had a couple of hours of talking, sometimes your memory is jogged into, you know, remembering something else. And we can share that phone number with you if that's something that happens. Otherwise, unless there's anything else you want to chat about, I'm going to go ahead and thank you and turn the machine off.
Sign off.
All right. That sounds good.
I'm sure it's there.
Yeah, it's the one thing, just as long as I don't erase it, right?
Yeah, no kidding. I've taken notes, but not that good of notes.
Um.